Hello, everyone, and welcome to Employment Matters, brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm your host, Tara Stingley, a partner with Klein Williams in Omaha, Nebraska. Here on Employment Matters, we bring you updates from around the world as we dial in our local ELA lawyers. These good folks practice on the ground in jurisdictions around the globe, working daily to help their clients move through these difficult times. On the program, we span the globe with updates on critical issues from ELA members in each region. Today, we're chatting with ELA members from Minnesota and New York. Joining us on the program are Megan Anderson, a partner at Lathrop GPM in Minnesota, and Barbara Lee, an attorney with Bond, Shenick & King in upstate New York. We know that policies and issues affecting transgender individuals are advancing every day. And today, Megan and Barbara will be discussing these issues within higher education institutions and the effect that policies and procedures, particularly the expanded coverage of Title IX, have on administrations, faculty, and students. Megan and Barbara, welcome to the program. How are you both today?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me.
And I'm equally good and looking forward to our chat.
Well, thanks for joining us today. Megan, let's start with the basics. Can you talk to us about how the application of Title IX to discrimination against individuals on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation, how will that impact colleges and universities?
I think the biggest impact right now is that with the Supreme Court ruling in June of 2020, the Bostock ruling, we now have uniformity around the country. And all higher education institutions that receive federal Title IV funds now clearly have an obligation not to discriminate or permit harassment based on LGBTQ+ status, both as to students and employees. And before June of 2020, what we really had was a split of legal authority around the country. So protections really depended on where your institution was located and where your students and employees were located. Obviously, we have Brown campuses. We also have institutions that offer online programming to students. And so it was a challenge, I think, for institutions to figure out what their obligations were because the law was really divided around the country. Before June of 2020, we didn't have any federal discrimination statute that expressly prohibited either gender identity or sexual orientation discrimination. Either in the student context or the employment context, what we had was federal prohibitions on sex discrimination and a growing debate around the country among government agencies and courts around whether sex discrimination necessarily encompasses LGBTQ discrimination. And then we had a minority of states around the country that did expressly prohibit LGBTQ discrimination. Minnesota, where I'm located, is one of the states that had a law like that, but we had this inconsistency. And in June of 2020, the Supreme Court ruled on a trio of employment cases, actually under Title VII, which is an employment discrimination law that applies to employers with 15 or more employees. So not a Title IX case, but an employment case, and held that sex discrimination does include LGBTQ discrimination. And what has happened since then is after President Biden took office in January, one of the very first things he did was issue an executive order in January directing all of the federal agencies to look at other federal sex discrimination laws, including Title IX, and to, where appropriate, where the law was similar to Title VII, to interpret them consistent with that Bostock ruling. And since that point in time, the U.S. Department of Education has come out with some guidance, and they are now taking the position that Title IX clearly does encompass LGBTQ status.
Thanks, Megan. Now, Barbara, what are some of the specific issues that college and university attorneys and their clients need to look out for in this arena? For example, are there issues involving faculty that we need to be aware of in this context in light of these legal developments?
Absolutely. There's a lot going on, and I have a feeling that many institutions need a little bit of help getting ready to deal with these issues. For example, the use of pronouns, either in class or elsewhere. And in a little while, I'll be talking about a particular lawsuit involving the use of pronouns in class, but a transgender individual in particular may wish to be addressed by the pronoun that conforms with that person's gender identity, not necessarily with their legal name or their biological sex from birth. And I think most faculty are sympathetic with this, but others may not be for a variety of reasons. So class rosters may need to be updated, for example, to include the name that the student has chosen rather than their legal name. And faculty in particular, but also staff, will need to be aware that this is the name and this is the pronoun that be used for this student, whether it's the official legal name or pronoun or not. Another issue is housing. How and what to tell people? Are you going to tell potential roommates prior to assigning housing that they're going to be living in the same room with a transgender individual? I think that's a tough issue. I don't have a perfect answer for that, but that's something that colleges, I'm sure, are dealing with right now. How to handle single-sex residence halls or single-sex floors in a residence hall? And will transgender individuals be welcomed into a single-sex residence hall or floor? Restroom and locker rooms and access to restrooms and locker rooms and how they're designed to accommodate privacy concerns. And it isn't only transgender individuals who have privacy concerns. So that's something else that colleges and universities will need to think about. And as we heard from Megan, Title IX is now including additional protected classes that have never been involved before. Sex up until recently meant biological sex. Now transgender individuals want to or go ahead and file Title IX complaints on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity? And if so, how will investigators and adjudicators be trained to deal with these issues that they may never have dealt with before? Athletics issues, we'll talk about that later in the podcast, but athletics issues are a real, both an educational and a political firestorm right now. And the jury's out on exactly what's going to happen with that. And I know that Megan's going to talk about healthcare issues, but I just want to mention that college staff need to understand that transgender individuals as a class, not necessarily as an individual, but as a class, are at a higher risk of both harassment and suicide. And that's, the data are clear on that. So what is the college going to do to ensure that these individuals are protected from both of those problems? And that's probably enough to scare any college. So I'll stop with that list.
There's been some discussion about potential religious exemptions. Megan, can you talk to us about how religious exemptions come up in this arena and what higher education institutions need to be aware of?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. There's two types of religious exemptions that come up under federal sex discrimination laws, and in particular, Title VII, which again applies to employees, and then Title IX, which applies to both students and employees in the higher ed setting. And, you know, if you fall within one of these exemptions, essentially either the institution itself is not covered by the non-discrimination laws or the employee, one of the exemptions is employment related, the employee may not be covered. So one of the exemptions is a religious institution exemption. So that applies to the institution itself. And the other exemption is for ministerial positions in the employment setting. So that exemption really depends on the role that the employee holds. And I'll just give a really high level overview of both exemptions and kind of the purpose of them and how they work. But I will say these are really nuanced and they're quite narrow. And so if an institution thinks that either they or an employee fit within an exemption, it's really important to consult with legal counsel because it's a pretty fact specific, nuanced analysis. So I'll start with the religious institution exemption. The purpose behind that exemption is to allow religious entities to hire and employ people who share the religion of that institution and follow that institution's practices and beliefs. And the courts and agencies typically look at a multiple of factors to decide if an institution fits within a religious institution, you know, not exhaustive, but some of them are whether or not it's a nonprofit, whether it has any secular activities, whether its governing documents state a religious purpose to the institution, whether there's ownership or affiliation or financial support from a religious institution. They also look at whether religious entities have any role in the governance. Sometimes board of trustees include representation by religious individuals affiliated with the entity. They're going to look at how you hold yourself out. So an institution that holds itself out publicly as religious and who requires its faculty and its staff and its students, for example, to sign declarations around their commitment to the institution's religious beliefs, that's going to be another factor. It's not a complete exemption. Again, the focus is on allowing the institution to hire and employ people who share their religious beliefs. That certainly could come up in the context of LGBTQ discrimination, given that there are religions who believe strongly, right, that being cisgender and being heterosexual is really the only option. And so you could see the exemption come up in this context, but it probably wouldn't apply, for example, in the race context. Turning then to the other type of exemption, that one is a ministerial exemption. And again, that applies based on the position that an employee holds. And the purpose behind that exemption is to try to avoid entanglement under the First Amendment between government action and religion. And so if an employee is ministerial, the courts and agencies simply say, we are not going to get involved in this higher institution's operations or decisions around hiring and firing and the treatment of that employee. The ministerial exception certainly would apply to somebody who truly holds a minister or clergy position, but we've had some fairly recent court cases, including a 2020 Supreme Court decision in a case called Our Lady of Guadalupe, in which faculty positions in particular have sometimes been held to be ministerial. So that's another exemption that might apply. And again, if the exemptions apply, that's a complete block to somebody claiming these protections under Title IX or Title VII.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The future of work is constantly shifting. How can HR leaders stay on top of the latest trends to better lead their global workforce to success? Serva Soundbites podcast explores current trends and the hottest topics around global employee relocation and the future of work. We connect with industry experts, HR leaders, and innovative thinkers to share their insights and stories. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your business podcasts.
Definitely a nuanced area and one to get legal counsel on if you think you might be heading down that road. Now, Barbara, you mentioned earlier the issue of restrooms and interactions between faculty and potential discrimination in this issue. Let's kind of turn back to that and talk a little bit more about what should colleges and universities do if coworkers are refusing to interact with a transgender employee, or they're complaining that a coworker, let's say a transgender woman, is using the women's restroom. How does a college or university sort through those different issues and find resolution to them?
Well, that's a really tough issue, Tara. And here we have two laws, both well-intentioned, one protecting against religious discrimination and another protecting against discrimination on the basis of transgender status or sexual orientation. And the question is, which one wins? And that's not an easy question to answer. So, first part of your question, how to handle employees whose religious beliefs are contrary to the recognition of either sexual orientation or gender identity. And as I said, these individuals are protected in the exercise of their religious beliefs. If they're in public institutions, they have constitutional protection. If they're in private institutions, they have non-discrimination laws, which of course apply to employees in both public and private institutions. So they have rights, but of course, so do the individuals on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. So most agencies and most courts take the position that employers can enforce reasonable work conduct rules, all right? And that it's not religious discrimination or a failure to accommodate to a sincerely held religious belief to require employees to treat each other with dignity and respect. Whether they disapprove of their lifestyle or their sexual orientation or whatever, as long as the conduct of the employee that they are disparaging is legal, they are required to behave themselves and be respectful and treat them with dignity. But it can be complicated. There are a couple of issues. One is the perennial restroom issue, where cisgender women do not want to have to share a women's restroom with transgender women. And that has been addressed on a number of occasions. And I think the easiest analogy to use is the discrimination claims in the 1960s and 1970s, when employers didn't want to allow African Americans into their places of public accommodation because their customers would object. And we called that the customer preferences line of litigation. Well, it's the same idea here. You have to obey the law, even if your employees or your customers, for that matter, object to your obeying law. And so that involves training It involves understanding. It involves conversations with the employees who are objecting. And it also requires empathy. And I think most well-meaning people, even if they're not completely comfortable with having to share a women's restroom with a transgender woman, and there are other ways to deal with it too. The institution can create gender-neutral restrooms. I mean, there are lots of creative ways to do it without punishing the transgender individual for being transgender. But a very tough issue, and I think it probably will happen even more, is how are the faculty going to be behaving? And there was a very recent case out of the Sixth Circuit called Meriwether versus Shawnee State, or Meriwether versus Hartop. And it's important to know that Shawnee State is a public, obviously, state institution. So the First Amendment's free speech and free exercises clauses apply here, where they wouldn't apply at a private institution, but you could have the same problem. This was a professor of philosophy who's a devout Christian who refused to use female pronouns for a trans woman and refused to call the trans woman by her chosen name, which was different from the individual's name on the roster. And the professor was told to use no pronouns, just don't use pronouns, call them by their name. And he said he couldn't call the student a woman because that violated his religious beliefs. So after a fairly protracted process, the institution decided that he had created a hostile academic environment for the student, and they said that they would discipline him. So he sued in federal court. The trial court dismissed the case, but the appellate court reversed and ruled in his favor, saying that he had a right under the First Amendment to free speech and that these issues were matters of public concern. Being a transgender individual, it's high on the public agenda, and actually created an exception, and I don't want to go into detail on this, although I would love to a Supreme Court case called Garcetti that said that public employees have no First Amendment rights if they're speaking with respect to what they do for their work. So if the speech is work-related, they have no First Amendment rights, says the Supreme Court. But there have been a few federal circuits that have created an academic exception for Garcetti, so that if faculty are speaking in class or out of class for that matter, on a matter that's relevant to their academic job, they are protected by the First Amendment. And in fact, the Sixth Circuit created that academic exception in this particular case dealing with a transgender student. So the school lost on both free speech and free exercise theories, and they were not able to discipline the individual at all, the faculty member. So I'm very concerned because colleges and universities have non-discrimination policies that say you must, you know, act in a way that is not discriminatory toward individuals. And many, many colleges have included gender identity and sexual orientation in those policies. And now everyone probably will need to because of the broadening of Title IX. So I think we're going to see a lot more litigation on this religious freedom issue versus non-discrimination. It's already coming.
Yeah, it certainly seems inevitable and hard to reconcile those principles in that kind of context. Megan, I know that you wanted to jump in on this issue too.
Yeah, I'll just add a few observations. I think Barbara's right that we're going to see more litigation. Obviously, under the Trump administration, you know, the protection of religious liberties was a big priority issue, and we had a real shift in the makeup of our federal courts. And so that may impact how some of these cases come out. I personally think that not every court will rule the way the Sixth Circuit did, because there's an argument to be made that you're not discriminating based on religion when you make people adhere to conduct standards. You're saying, believe what you want, practice what religion you want, but when you come into the workplace or our campus community, there are some community standards of conduct. And to the extent that you have to accommodate religious beliefs, you only have to reasonably accommodate. You don't have to do things that aren't undue hardships. So I could see that shaking out differently, potentially with a different court. And then I just thought I'd tag on to the restroom comments and just mention that the Bostock rulings, those Supreme Court cases that I mentioned, did not involve any restroom access issues. And in fact, the Supreme Court expressly said, we're not ruling on that. We're leaving to another day whether a prohibition on LGBTQ discrimination would require gender identity-based access to restrooms. And so the state of the law is a little bit like what I discussed at the beginning of the podcast when it comes to restrooms, that we have a lot of restrooms cases around the country with some different results. So it's a good idea to consult with legal counsel there too. But I will say certainly the best practice, I think, is emerging to be access based on gender identity. And the US Supreme Court did very recently decline review of an education case involving transgender access to restrooms and let stand the appellate ruling. This was out of the Fourth Circuit, holding that a transgender student needed to be allowed restroom access based on gender identity. So they didn't rule on the merits, but they did let that stand. A lot of organizations that I see are doing what Barb said. If they're doing new construction or they're remodeling, they're trying to be proactive about, you know, more single-use gender-neutral options so that they create a lot more options. And then if you are allowing gender identity access and you have somebody else who's really uncomfortable with that, you also can give them other options. And so that can be a good creative solution.
Both of you have touched on so many different facets to higher education, particularly the co-curricular side of the institution. Can you talk to us about how the expansion of Title IX's coverage has implications for student housing, student organizations, and locker rooms, again, like we've already talked about?
Sure, absolutely. There are implications really throughout the college or university with this expansion of Title IX. We'll just start with housing, for example. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development enforces the Fair Housing Act. And the Fair Housing Act applies to both public and private colleges and universities. And it includes prohibitions on discrimination on the basis of sex. And now that the Biden administration is applying Lostock to Title IX in the president's executive order, that means that the Fair Housing Act applies to sexual orientation and gender identity, as well as to biological sex. So that is a new one for colleges and universities. So this raises the question about single-sex dorms or rooms, single-sex rooms, and will schools need to give access to an all-women's dorm, for example, to someone who was born biologically, or at least identified biologically as male at birth, but who identifies as female? And that seems to be a best practice to allow transgender women, for example, into women's dorms and transgender males into male dorms. But there certainly are going to be some core challenges. And there is already one that I can tell you about. The College of the Ozarks in Missouri, which is a private, religiously affiliated college, is suing HUD, saying that requiring the college to, quote, open female showers, restrooms, and dorm rooms to biological males who assert a female identity violates their religious beliefs. And that HUD's directive forces the college to violate its religiously informed code of conduct. A trial court dismissed the lawsuit, saying that there had been no injury yet to the college, but that dismissal has been appealed to the Eighth Circuit, and that court has promised a hearing in November of this year. So we should find out pretty soon at least what the Eighth Circuit thinks about this. And then moving on to student organizations. Recent circuit court opinions have found for student plaintiffs when they alleged a college's non-discrimination policy, one that, as many do, includes both sexual orientation and gender identity as protected classes, way before the Bostock case. Many colleges and universities had these very inclusive non-discrimination policies, and that they interfered with a religious student organization's constitutional right under the First Amendment at public colleges and universities, now this is, to limit membership to students who agree with the organization's religious doctrine. So these, like the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, for example, which has lots and lots and lots of members on various campuses all over the country, insists that their members agree with the student organization's religious beliefs and doctrines. And the University of Iowa deregistered that organization because it, quote, discriminated against individuals who did not share the religious beliefs and, in fact, who were either gay or transgender. And the trial court ruled against the university, saying that the exclusion of individuals was a violation of their First Amendment free exercise rights. And so expansion of Title IX in this case could also make these organizations' exclusionary membership rules a possible Title IX violation. So this could be on at private schools as well, because private schools don't have to worry about the free exercise clause. So again, big issues for student organizations on campus. And then don't get me started on athletics. We'll talk about that in a while, but there's a lot going on with athletics too. And all I can say is stay tuned.
Well, you brought it up, so let's jump right into it. Let's talk about athletics for a minute. I've heard that some states have banned transgender athletes from college and university athletic teams. I imagine the NCAA has something to say about this. What information can you share with us on that point?
Yes, there's been a lot going on in the area of athletics, and I wish I could say it's finished, but it's ongoing. And so this, what I'm saying, I believe is accurate as of today, but it's a very fluid situation. So in 2010, the NCAA issued its first policy on transgender student athlete participation. So it was a bit ahead of the curve on this issue. And they consulted with experts in science, medicine, and inclusion, and put together this policy that they've been enforcing ever since. The policy was recently updated. So this is the most recent information from the NCAA. And I'm going to read it to you because they're using a lot of big words here, and I want to make sure that we all understand what they're saying. So they talk about a trans male, and they talk about a trans female, okay? So a trans male is a female to male transgender individual, all right? Female to male student athlete who has received a medical exception for treatment with testosterone for diagnosed gender identity disorder, which is a recognized psychiatric disorder, or gender dysphoria, and or transsexualism. So the student has to have a diagnosis from a medical professional. For purposes of NCAA competition, may compete on men's team. So this is female to male student athlete may compete on a men's team, but is no longer eligible to compete on a woman's team without changing that team to a mixed gender status team. So the team would have to have both male and female athletes on it. So that's pretty straightforward. So the complicated one is the trans female situation. And this is where a lot of the legal issues come up. This is a allegedly biological male transitioning to a female, all right, student athlete being treated with testosterone suppression medicine so that the testosterone is being suppressed synthetically in the individual's body. Again, they've given the medication for gender identity disorder or gender dysphoria or transsexualism. Again, these either psychiatric or medical conditions. For the purpose of NCAA competition, this trans female may continue to compete on a men's team, all right, but may not compete on a women's team without changing it to a mixed team status until, and this is the kicker here, until they complete one calendar year of testosterone suppression treatment. So a trans female must take testosterone suppression medication for at least a year before she's allowed to compete on a women's team under NCAA rules. Okay? And that's where all the hysteria comes in. So any transgender student athlete who's not taking hormone treatment related to gender transition may participate, we're still with the NCAA here, in sex-separated sports activities in accordance with his or her assigned birth gender. So if they're not taking hormones to mimic the gender identity that they express, then they can only participate on the teams that align with their biological or birth assigned sex. So the NCAA policy actually is very thoughtful. It includes suggested best practices and guidelines for athletic staff and media and others, as well as a list of the students' responsibilities and the college's responsibilities in terms of disclosure, medication, that sort of thing.
Now we have the NCAA. Are state authorities taking a different approach on this and taking action of their own?
As of today, 9 states have passed laws forbidding public schools from allowing transgender women to play on women's athletic teams. And over 20 additional states have such legislation pending. And several of these laws also apply to public colleges and universities, not just K-12 schools. So these are the states whose laws now prohibit transgender women from competing on a college's women's athletics team: Arkansas, West Virginia, Florida, Montana, South Dakota, Idaho, and Mississippi. Now, several of these laws are under legal challenge, as you might imagine. The courts have enjoined the enforcement of the Idaho and West Virginia laws, so they're not enforceable right now. And the ACLU is challenging the other laws. And then in other states, laws where they don't have laws that forbid this participation, state athletic associations, which regulate high school competition, have permitted transgender women to participate in public high school sports. But then again, some of these associations have been sued by the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is the organization that also is supporting the religious student organizations on campus that I spoke about a few minutes ago. So stay tuned. There's a lot going on in this area.
I think we could schedule a whole series of follow-up programs and podcasts on that issue alone of athletics. Megan, let me jump back to you for a minute. This is a really complicated area, and folks in higher ed don't want to be caught flat-footed. What actions should colleges and universities take right now so they're prepared to respond to these issues involving transgender students or employees?
There's a whole host of things that institutions should be thinking about doing. I'll tick through what I consider some best practices, you know, at a high level, and there's tons of great resources out there online as well for institutions. You know, first and foremost, you've got to make sure that you are doing the things you need to be doing from a policy and a training standpoint to prevent discrimination and harassment based on LGBTQ status. And a lot of the things that you would do here are things that institutions should be used to doing in other areas, right? For other protected characteristics, like sex and race and national origin and religion, but you've got to make sure that your policies are up to date in terms of their language and that you are ensuring that they're more than a piece of paper, that you're really walking the walk, that people are aware of the policies, they know how to report concerns, and that you as an institution are, you know, jumping on those concerns and processing them under your complaint and investigation and response procedures. You've also got to do training. And that training, I personally think, should really vary and be customized by audience. So what you do for your students and your staff at large might be different than what you do for individuals at your institution who may have some heightened responsibilities in this area, like your faculty, your Title IX team, your deans who interact regularly with students, your registrar's office, your admissions folks, right, who are on the front line of dealing with prospective students, because these laws also apply to applicants. And Barbara mentioned this earlier. I mean, beyond just training on conduct expectations and how to report concerns and all of that, I think training has to involve some sort of core competencies. You know, what is the terminology that's appropriate to use within the LGBTQ community? What are some sort of cultural competency pieces? Because you've got to equip people to be able, you know, to work with you as you try to create a diverse and inclusive and welcoming environment. And if they aren't sort of culturally competent, they're not going to do a very good job at that. You know, I also think you've got to think proactively around the experience of a prospective or existing community member. You know, what are the things that they would expect to be seeing and expect you to be doing to feel like it's an inclusive and welcoming place? And there's lots and lots of things, you know, out there. I'm not going to touch on all of them. A lot of institutions, I think, have developed task force and standing committees to make sure that they're kind of doing a comprehensive audit, you know, of their policies and practices to try to improve them. But for sure, some of the things you should be thinking about are, you know, the forms that you're using, whether it's in paper or online, the language that you're using in policies on and on your websites to make sure it's inclusive. You know, we've had a longstanding sort of stereotypical view of gender as binary. So we've all experienced this where you're filling out, you know, hard copy forms or online forms, and the only options to check are male and female. And we really have to move away from that and have more inclusive options, and also, you know, not assume that everybody is cisgender, not assume that everybody is heterosexual. And that's easier to control when the institution is developing the forms, but you're working with lots of vendors and you have lots of technology platforms. So, you know, being proactive with your vendors, I think, is important. I am going to just touch briefly on healthcare services. You absolutely need to think about your healthcare services and your insurance coverage, whether that's for your employees or students. We have seen a number of lawsuits against both institutions and healthcare insurers where their policies do not provide appropriate coverage for gender identity focused treatments. And so you want to be looking substantively at your coverage, and you want to make sure your healthcare facilities have the right, you know, if you offer those on site, you want to make sure that you've got people who are trained and equipped to provide the services that LGBTQ individuals might need. Another sort of interesting thing that I've seen come up in the healthcare context is problems with sort of billing codes that make it a really complicated and sometimes inequitable system for transgender people in particular, where if the healthcare provider's billing codes are only binary, male and female, but you have a transgender individual whose anatomy doesn't match their gender identity, so they need a particular medical procedure based on their anatomy, but they've selected the other gender when they filled out forms, you can really run into a lot of complications and insurance denials. So I think being proactive about those things and kind of putting yourself in the shoes of the LGBTQ community member and kind of what's going to make it feel inclusive and welcoming to them are all important things. Barbara touched on names and pronouns, so I won't speak on that, but I think, you know, other things that I see organizations doing to try to build inclusion are having affinity groups, both at the student and employee level, bringing in speakers, you know, thinking about the publications that are, you know, laying around in lobby areas, thinking about where they recruit. The more you recruit and retain LGBTQ community members, just like with any other protected class, it's going to feel more welcoming when an LGBTQ community member looks around and they have other individuals, you know, at faculty, staff level and students that they relate to. So there's lots of other things, but that's just a high level overview of a number of things that I think are important to think about.
Yes, I concur completely with you, Megan, and just sort of a not legal comment here. We've talked a lot about the legal issues, and there's just no question that they're going to be challenging. They already are challenging, and that's not going to get any easier. And now, for the transgender and the gay community in particular, it's good that they have more avenues of protection because in many cases they have not. And I think we are going to see more, as we do when we do sexual harassment training, we see more complaints about sexual harassment come along. And now that these communities have more legal rights, I think we're going to be seeing more activity in this area. I think that colleges and universities and other organizations as well are need to going to prepare for pushback, not only from religiously conservative faculty and staff and students, but from others who simply don't understand the issues behind these very difficult choices that transgender individuals have had to make and how difficult those choices are and the implications of those choices and the fact that they deserve our respect and our support and in many ways our admiration.
Well, thank you both. We know these issues continue to evolve. There's certainly going to be more to come in this area. And thanks so much for taking the time to discuss these issues with us and joining us on the program today.
Thank you. It's been great to talk with both of you today.
Thank you for making it fun. I enjoyed it. And good luck to everyone with this tough issue.
Thank you both. If you'd like to connect with Megan or Barbara, please click on their bios in the description of this podcast. You can also search the ELA website at ela.law. where you can sign up to receive invitations to our upcoming webinars, download white papers and on-demand content from our online library, or access the ELA's exclusive Global Employer Handbook. You've been listening to Employment Matters, a podcast brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm Tara Stingley. Thanks so much for listening.